Today on Against the Grain, at a time when national governments are taking little action in the face of the climate emergency, the bicycle seems an ideal, if of course partial, remedy. It allows us to get around our cities and towns without polluting them or producing greenhouse gases. And often cities that have encouraged biking by putting in bicycle lanes and other infrastructure feel more vibrant and livable. But geographer John Stalen suggests that while there is much to commend about bikes, their advocates have also played an unwitting role in the gentrification of cities. I'm Sasha Lilly. John Stalen joins me next. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Bikes are a significant presence in many large and small cities around the United States. Commuters on bikes, dockless bikes, bike sharing arrangements of all sorts. It would look like a small victory is being achieved in American cities, which of course are still dominated by cars. But this partial victory may be smaller than it seems. In Cyclescapes of the Unequal City, Bicycle Infrastructure and Uneven Development, published by the University of Minnesota Press, John Stalen examines the role that bikes have played in the gentrification of U.S. cities, in which poor people and people of color have been displaced by the more affluent. He's assistant professor in the Department of Geography, Environment, and Sustainability at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. John, could you sum up for us the promise of bicycles for those who would consider themselves bike advocates?
It's kind of a manifold question. I think for most of the advocates that I know and that I interviewed for the book and the people that I just came to know as part of doing the research, I think, first of all, the promise of the bike is climate and carbon, reducing carbon emissions and reducing car trips. I think that's a big part of it. But I think there's a deeper issue of kind of humanizing the city. That goes way back to writers from the 1960s and the 1970s, Ivan Illich, for example, who was very influential at the time in the first kind of so-called bike boom of the early 1970s, and kind of bringing the city back to sort of a human scale, not necessarily just not walking pace, but the scale of the bicycle as a kind of localizing everyday social relations, getting people out of big steel boxes with glass that kind of separate people from each other, cars, and getting them to kind of interact more in a human pace. And I think that there's increasingly a kind of economic equity frame to it as well. When you look at the average costs of car ownership, yearly average costs of car ownership, if you have a new car and have new car payments, et cetera, is somewhere around $9,000. That's gas, maintenance, all the rest of it. In principle, getting around by bicycle under your own steam, so to speak, is the most one of the most cost-effective ways of getting through the city. And then, of course, part of what I'm trying to do in the book is think about how living where that is a kind of intuitive way of getting around the city is actually not very open to a lot of people.
Well, we've seen the resurgence in, or at least the visible resurgence of people riding bicycles in cities. But as you just mentioned, that's not new. And I wanted to ask you about what propelled people to get on bicycles in the 1970s. In what context did that turn to the bicycle take place?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't get a chance to really get into it in the book quite as much as I wanted to, because it wasn't primarily a historical study. But it's, I mean, some really fascinating stuff. It was obviously the kind of the 60s kind of zeitgeist, the student movements, the labor movements, the environmental movement especially. And the kind of, I just quickly touched on it, the notion of sort of humanizing everyday social relations. There's a great book by Fred Turner called From Counterculture to Cyberculture, where he traces the sort of the whole earth catalog and the kind of the back to the land commune movement generation, and how that flowed quite seamlessly actually into the kind of computer programming and Wired magazine kind of zeitgeist. And the bikes were very firmly, bicycling was very firmly part of this kind of rethinking your relationship to space, rethinking your relationship to the modern economy, right? Kind of going back to and sort of simplifying everyday life, which the bicycles are fairly easy to work on, especially, you know, once you have a little bit of experience, you know, breaking a few things, et cetera, et cetera. And so it was very attractive to the kind of whole earth catalog type of mentality. And then, of course, you have the 1973 oil crisis, and all of a sudden, gas prices go through the roof, and you're seeing long lines at the pump, and you see cities like, you know, Los Angeles talking about putting bike lanes in on major arterials because there was so much there was so much pressure to get out of cars, any other kind of vehicle, but bicycles. There was a huge boom in bicycling, not just because of the oil crisis, but because imports from Japan and Europe were becoming cheaper as well. And so you had a bicycle sales boom. This is when you saw tons and tons of Peugeots coming in from France. Of course, you had Raleighs from the UK and Schwinns from the US, but tons of bikes from Japan. So it was actually, it was this moment where the economic resurgence of Europe and Japan that had been obviously destroyed in World War II was quite visible just a bit before it was visible in the automobile sector. And so that was what was known as the bike boom. I think the peak was 1976 in terms of sales, but then there was bike centennial. There was this really kind of this big cultural flowering among that generation around bicycles. And then it quickly died off in the 1980s.
Well, then what led to the resurgence of bicycles and interest in bicycles in the 1990s and beyond to our present?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I'm grappling with in the book. And I think I have a pretty good answer in the book, which is that it has something to do with the restructuring of cities, that the patterns of gentrification that we started seeing in the 1990s and 2000s have deep roots going back, obviously, to redlining and disinvestment in central cities and suburbanization. But then the sort of the early, quote unquote, urban pioneer movements, you know, a term that I don't really like, but was used at the time in the 1960s and 70s. And then by the 1990s, those have gathered steam. Places like the Mission are becoming countercultural hubs. And you also had the restructuring more broadly of the economy towards what is called the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, and real estate. The way that the economy got sort of reorganized around finance, insurance, and real estate in central cities, producer services, increasingly in the 2000s and onward, the kind of knowledge-intensive economy. The clustering of new kinds of work, often quite creative work being done. And you had people, mostly white, middle-class people settling in relatively disinvested areas that were really proximate to central cities, where there was a lot of cultural events going on. It was a kind of a fertile cultural moment. And suddenly being able to bike to work, which is not the fastest mode of transportation, although it's pretty good in the city, is practical. You're in a relatively central location. You work centrally, you socialize centrally, and it becomes intuitive. Somebody said to me, Susan King, I think, of Transportation for a Livable City, I think it's just called Livable City now, said that she lost 2,000 pounds in one day. She sold her car, and it was because she was living in a kind of house with a lot of other single people, and they kept getting parking tickets because they all had cars and would forget street sweeping and get parking tickets. And she realized that, like, there was no need to actually own a car and use a car in the central city. And I think it was actually that practice of moving to central cities, which was part and parcel of gentrification when you look at it in a broad scale, that kind of introduced people or reintroduced people to this way of getting around.
What about how bike proponents, bike activists saw the bicycle in the 1990s and beyond? You write about critical mass, which originated here in the San Francisco Bay Area. What role did critical mass play in helping this bike resurgence?
Right. I mean, critical mass, it's a really fascinating story.
And perhaps you could say what critical mass is.
Right. So critical mass is, there are a lot of euphemisms for it, but it was basically a sort of an anarchic rolling carnival. It began in San Francisco with a bunch of folks. One of the more famous kind of early participants was Chris Carlson. It was this anarchic kind of taking back the streets, a history in a kind of like situationist type of anarchist reappropriation of space. So kind of enacting a politics of what the post-car city might look like. Began in 1992 and sort of quickly grew over the course of the 1990s. And interestingly, I mean, to go back to my earlier point, it began at the time Chris Carlson was writing a zine called Processed World that was about the sort of the new alienation of office work, right? The sort of the 1960s and 70s critique of alienation earlier, of course, from, you know, Marx and Engels, was about factory labor. And this was a critique of alienation that was about office labor. And it was people sharing a commute home. That was initially how it began. So it wasn't structured as a political protest. It was structured as a kind of political practice. And so it grew very dramatically over the course of the 1990s. And so by 1997, it was, you know, thousands of people on the last Friday of every month at around 5 p.m., just when the traffic should be worst, kind of retaking the streets by bicycle. And I think that the lore is that Willie Brown, who was mayor at the time, was stuck in traffic that was caused by critical mass. And it was, it emerged as a kind of political problem for him. So I think it was July 1997, he ordered the police to crack down and stop the ride. And it ended up being optically quite terrible. You know, you've got pictures of mounted police officers with their knees on an older person's neck, holding them down, confiscating bicycles, 100-some arrests, none of them actually prosecuted. It blew up in Brown's face, and the next month's ride was even bigger. And this was a time when the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition and Critical Mass were sort of shared basically the same membership, right? The Bike Coalition is a formal membership-based organization. Critical Mass is an informal, it's a non-organization, it's a happening. But it was basically the same group of people. I think Dave Snyder, who was executive director at the time, said initially that he tried to keep away from critical mass because they looked like the crazy anarchists and they were going to kind of impugn the bicycle movement that was very nascent. But what it actually did was create momentum behind the bicycle movement. And so he quickly kind of spun it as what critical mass is about is that people are angry that the city has a bike plan that is not being implemented. There was a bike plan that had just come out in 1997. And so it fueled a very different kind of approach to the politics of bicycling, which is the politics of infrastructure, putting down durable infrastructure, engaging with the planning process, engaging with a planning process that has to balance a number of mandates, one of which is sort of not wrecking a good business climate, so to speak. And so I think that's when you also see the divergence between the more kind of the radical anarchist inspired politics of bicycling and the more consensus-based win-win politics that the bicycle movement all over, not just in San Francisco, starts to go as they start to get traction in city governments. City governments are seeing, oh, actually, you know, these places that have bicycle infrastructure are seeing a higher quality of life. Maybe there's a bit more kind of a lively street feel. This is something that we should be encouraging.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm joined by John Stalen. He is a geographer and the author of Cyclescapes of the Unequal City. So you were just describing this moment in the 1990s where in the Bay Area, but not only in the Bay Area, there was the intersection of activist demands to have an infrastructure for bicycles and city planners and other members of city government lighting on the idea that having infrastructure for bicycles actually could be good for the growth of the city and economic growth. Tell us more about how that played out in cities across the U.S. and to what degree city governments got on this bandwagon easily.
Right. I mean, that's a tough question because it was pretty uneven. It is still pretty uneven. I think that there are a lot of places where city governments intuitively, maybe they want bicyclists for a sort of an image, but they don't necessarily want to make the difficult decisions around allocating road space, especially when it comes to traffic lanes and parking. But to move back to the San Francisco case, and that's what I focused on in the book, there's this particular moment around Valencia Street in the Mission District. And the reason that I focused on this particular case is it was an example of a moment when bicycle advocates worked very hard to create the narrative around bicycling being positive for business, being good for business. And it didn't necessarily come intuitively. I talk about in the book how in debates over what was going to happen on Valencia Street, which was a very popular bicycling route, but was not included in the bicycle plan of 1997 because it was going to require either taking away parking or taking away a travel lane. And the Department of Parking and Traffic, as it was known at the time, was not willing to do that. And so the head of Department of Parking and Traffic at the time said, there will be bike lanes on Valencia over my dead body. So it wasn't necessarily like an immediate meeting of the minds, so to speak. And what I focus on in that chapter of the book is how bicycle advocates worked very hard to propagate the narrative that what was called a road diet, where you remove two travel lanes, add a center turn lane, and that creates space to add bike lanes, that what was called a road diet was going to be good for business. It was going to slow people down. People were going to see what's in storefronts and maybe stop. If they're on bikes, of course, it's going to be very easy to stop and it's going to be safe people on bikes are not going to avoid your street for fear of getting hit by cars. And so it was ultimately a success, both from a safety perspective, and later was narrated as a success in economic terms as well. This is in 1999. Of course, the timing of that totally coincides with the first expression of the tech boom. And so you have this moment where the Mission District and Valencia Street in particular is just absolutely booming. The bike lanes are put in, people are visibly bicycling, and those become part of the kind of the same narrative. In other cities, you see some of the same narratives, but what you see more is an increasingly sophisticated lobbying narrative coming from not the quote-unquote all-powerful bicycle lobby that people like to joke about, but coming from bicycle organizations with a national footprint, with the ear of a few members of Congress. Earl Blumenauer from Oregon is a major one. And propagating the narrative of bicycling being good for business. And they expand beyond just the kind of Frank Capra-esque Main Street type of local economy to talk about a healthy workforce, a more productive workforce, attracting talent, the kinds of things that Richard Florida wrote about in Cities in the Creative Class. In fact, he talks about bicycling in that book as something that the quote-unquote creatives, this new, very footloose, culturally vibrant kind of class involved in the knowledge economy, the kinds of things that they want to see cities do. And so that's to me in a lot of ways how it spreads. It's not a Valencia Street case by Valencia Street case by Valencia Street case in different cities. It's really that Valencia story starts to circulate through these networks. And there's a similar story about bike lanes on 8th Avenue, I think it is, in New York City, that it raised local sales tax receipts X amount, et cetera, et cetera. So you get these stories that start to find their way into blog posts and find their way into planning documents, and they find their way into popular narratives about what bicycling can do for cities.
One of the threads that, of course, runs through this story about bicycles and the transformation of American cities has to do with race and class. And you just mentioned cities' attempts to consciously attract young, skilled workers into cities, certainly in the Bay Area, with a model of having them work for tech. And that sort of dovetails with the stereotype that I think a lot of people have in their minds, that someone cycling in a city is a young, middle-class white person. I want to ask you in a moment about people of color in cycling, but tell us about this question of race and whiteness as it relates to cycling in cities in the last several decades.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, really tricky question because it is actually constantly changing. And how different practices get racialized is constantly changing. And I think it actually looks somewhat different even now than when I was doing some of the research. But in terms of, I don't necessarily see I don't, of course, see anything kind of inherently white about bicycling. I think what happens is in places like West Philadelphia, where I lived before I came to the Bay Area to start my PhD, and where I worked at a bike shop, like many other sort of young, fairly broke, but, white and well-educated people, we were kind of living at what Neil Smith called the gentrification frontier, quote unquote. And I think it's not as much that there is something inherent to, you know, inherently racialized about the practice of bicycling. It was more how people became visible via bicycles in a way that felt very novel, right? The stereotype of a bicyclist in, say, the, you know, maybe 20 years ago was, you know, a radical environmentalist or someone who's too poor to own a car, or somebody who lost their license due to a DUI, or maybe in a small town, a kind of university professor in a tweed jacket, right? Those are the popular stereotypes. In neighborhoods like East Oakland, I've talked to bicycle advocates, you know, both folks with Bike East Bay and folks with the Scraper Bike Team, where people will say, you know, bikes are for poor people or for yuppies, right? It doesn't land, and it hasn't historically landed as a kind of normative middle class practice. And of course, our senses of what is normatively middle class are deeply racialized in the United States. And so I think it's that novelty, and not just the novelty of a middle class person visibly kind of, if you want to talk about clothing, style of, you know, lifestyle, whatever you can kind of divine at a brief moment of seeing a bicyclist. We're also talking about the places in which they are emerging, where people are becoming visible as novel in new spaces. Spaces that if white people were traveling through those spaces, say like parts of West Oakland, parts of East Oakland, South Berkeley, West Berkeley, if white people were traveling through those spaces, they're often in cars, which doesn't necessarily, they may be equally involved in gentrification, but it doesn't register as novel, I think, in the same way. There's something to actually how bicycling as a practice makes you visible that I think matters for the story.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the author of Cyclescapes of the Unequal City, Bicycle Infrastructure and Uneven Development. John Stalen is assistant professor in the Department of Geography, Environment, and Sustainability at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. So let me ask you about people of color and cycling. People of color, in terms of the stereotypes that leap to mind as you've been discussing, there is a connection in people's imaginations between bicyclists and white people. And yet, obviously, people of color have long ridden bicycles. Poor people, who often are disproportionately people of color, have resorted for many, many decades to bicycles as their means of transportation. What can be said about the trajectory of bicycling by people of color over the last 30 years?
Yeah, that's a great question. In New York, for example, the subculture of bicycle messengers was dominated by immigrants from the West Indies. And that was a sort of a key part of bike messenger culture, including down to the fixed gear bicycles, which came largely from that West Indian influence. So there is a kind of very long history of people who are marginalized in terms of class and race and the division of labor, taking up bicycling both as a, you know, urban survival strategy and as a livelihood strategy in the sense of, you know, using the bicycle for work, right? Whether it's in the formal economy or the informal economy. When you get to, say, the 1990s, I had a participant in Critical Mass who had been around from the beginning of Critical Mass, and he said that one of the images that was seared into his mind of Critical Mass and the experience of being in Critical Mass is angry white bicyclists holding up a limo where the chauffeur was black, right? That And that was something that had stuck with him, where there was, to a degree, bicyclists were claiming a kind of what Antonio Gramsci called a subaltern status, right? A certain degree of oppression or exclusion. At the same time, I think it's been said by a number of different people, Adonio Lugo being one of them, that it's often being on a bicycle is the first experience that a cisgendered white man, middle-class white man, is likely to feel structural oppression, right? The kind of the actual structure of space is endangering their lives. I'll say also that part of what got me interested in this project was, I mentioned that I lived in Philadelphia prior to moving to the San Francisco Bay Area, and I worked as a bicycle mechanic. And I worked as a bicycle mechanic just off of South Street on 9th and South at a shop called Via Bicycle that had become a hub for the bicycle scene in that area, both kind of high-end people interested in sort of rare and valuable collector's items, but also really everyday bicycle users. There were a lot of people who visited that shop who were immigrants from Central America and Mexico. And part of my job was actually speaking Spanish most of the day. And most of these men, and they were almost exclusively men, were riding bicycles from Walmart or Target that they had bought to deliver food or to get home from their restaurant jobs, washing dishes at 3 a.m., that kind of thing. So it was very much a kind of a marginalized group of people who were using bicycles and actually who knew quite a lot about bicycles, who were using bicycles on a daily basis because it was the cheapest way to get around. There were also a lot of longtime residents of that part of Philadelphia, a lot of lower income African American residents who had been going to that same bike shop for, you know, 20, 25, 30 years. At the same time, this was exactly the same time as you started to get the narrative of the sort of the white hipsters on fixed gears. They were also coming to that shop. So the shop was a kind of nexus of a lot of different, it's almost like different kind of tectonics, different segments of bicycle culture or bicycle usage that came together in that one place. One of the things that has been very interesting in doing this research is the way in which the question of race and the racialization of the bicycle movement and its domination by middle-class white people and, you know, middle-class white men, it should be said as well, is that the kind of rethinking of what the bike movement is for has really been due to pressure by bicycle advocates of color themselves, right? So it wasn't people sort of gradually, people in the movement, the sort of the old guard of largely middle-class white bicycle advocates kind of seeing the light. It was really due to pressure and kind of really autonomous activity on the part of bicycle advocates of color, you know, people like the Scraper Bike Team in East Oakland, people like Najari Smith with Rich City Rides, people like Oletunji Oboye-Reed in Chicago, who has a project called Equiticity, but came into questions of equity in planning through bicycle advocacy and advocating for people of color. And so I think it's really different in different places. One of the places that I talk about in the book that I found most fascinating was the city of Detroit, that has an incredibly vibrant bicycle scene that is substantially in a lot of ways led by people of color, and specifically clubs organized by Black churches in Detroit's neighborhoods. And the neighborhoods is a sort of a term given to the parts of the city that are not part of the downtown that is undergoing a boom, what is called the 7.2, because it's 7.2 square miles. And so it's substantially led by longtime Detroit residents, longtime working class Detroit residents, not new immigrants who are coming to work at Quicken Loans or Ford's new autonomous vehicle research center in Corktown. Nevertheless, they also participate in the bike culture. So it's this kind of really interesting intersection, and a lot of the practices of big group rides that are akin to critical mass, but way more kind of organized. It's called slow roll. A lot of it is sort of actually taking a lot of cyclists who maybe don't live in Detroit to places that they would never have otherwise seen, coming to the city and maybe just coming for a ball game or just coming to go to a new high-end restaurant and then going back to, you know, the suburb that they came from.
I want to ask you about how you understand the processes driving the role of bicycles in both gentrification and, broadly speaking, uneven development in cities. It's been noted that there has been a turn towards cities of middle and upper class people moving into the center of cities and in the process displacing poor people, people of color. But you argue that what has happened with bicycles isn't just simply the outgrowth of that turn to city centers. Can you explain why you think that's the case?
Yeah, I mean, so the way that I see it is that the emergence of bicycling at the moments that we've seen this sort of this resurgence, right, is absolutely linked to what Neil Smith called the kind of the seesaw motion of capital, right? So the title of the book is a nod to Neil Smith's work on uneven development. And basically the argument is that the wave of suburbanization that we've seen, and you know, the suburbanization and particularly suburbanization, not just of residential construction, but the suburbanization of offices and the suburbanization of work, is partially starting to break down, right? That created these kind of, in economic terms, land value sort of valleys within the central city. And you're now seeing the sort of that wave reverse. And Neil Smith's argument was that working class people kind of caught it on both ends. Their neighborhoods were disinvested in that first wave. And then in the returning wave, then they're displaced. It's a good kind of very macro level account of how gentrification fits into the sort of the land process under capitalism, kind of at the widest scale. But it doesn't explain how and why it's bikes, right? It doesn't explain why bikes and not some other mode of transportation, right? And to me, that's where my training in science and technology studies and thinking really seriously about the materiality of technology and infrastructure, that's where that influence comes in, because there's something about the way in which people are able to quickly and flexibly move through urban space on bicycles. And by people in this case, I mean people who are riding the wave of investment back into cities, right? Riding the sort of the kind of cultural and economic resurgence of cities. Not necessarily gentrifiers themselves in the sense of people buying up properties, reinvesting in them, and selling them on to middle-class buyers, right? But people in all kind of positions within the process. And I think that it's the ability to quickly and flexibly move through urban space It's cheaper than a car. It is obviously cheaper than a car. The issues around parking are not an issue really at all for bicycles, except for in terms of theft, but in terms of like the storing the vehicle on the street. The flexibility, I think, is really important. You're not stuck with a mass transit timetable. And I had so many people tell me over the course of my research that part of what drove them to bicycle was the unreliability of the bus. And so we have to actually contextualize it not just in the context of the patterns of land development, but the patterns of disinvestment in all kinds of other social infrastructure of the city. Disinvestment in mass transit, disinvestment in public services, right? So the bicycle becomes a way to navigate the city sort of on the cheap, very flexibly, and I think gives people who are kind of at the leading edge of gentrification, so to speak, a wider spatial range than if they were, say, walking to a BART station or walking to work. But at the same time, is part of trying to actually practice on a daily basis people's sense of environmental sustainability and social justice. Because we also have to remember that that a really, really foundational moment in the politics of bicycling, at least as they relate to critical mass and the San Francisco Bay Area, was the Iraq War and what was very transparently a war that was over fossil fuels and that there was an intimate connection between bloodshed abroad and our habits of mobility at home.
John Stalen is my guest. He's a geographer and author of Cyclescapes of the Unequal City. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you were just detailing the ways that bicycles give all sorts of flexibility and obviously mobility to the inhabitants of cities and people who may have been attracted into cities to relocate and work. And I wanted to ask you the other side of that, which is how have city governments thought about the questions that arise with the challenges that they may face in the model that they've embraced of trying to attract well-paid workers into city centers to gentrify those cities and, of course, displace the residents? How have they come to see bicycles as answering a number of the constraints they face within that model?
The kind of political constraints where it creates a kind of political backlash around gentrification. I would say that the green credentials of bicycles, which aren't made up, they're real, but the green credentials of bicycles, I think, play a big role in that because, part of what gives bicycling its kind of narrative power is the way that it fits into the very, very dire need to mitigate carbon emissions and kind of forestall the worst effects of climate change. So I don't think that it's not exactly greenwashing because it is actually something that can be materially beneficial. Unfortunately, it's not been adopted at anything like the scale that it would need to be adopted to have an impact on carbon emissions. But more broadly, the way that I see bicycling from when I put on my political economy hat, the way that I see bicycling fitting into this moment, right, is that cities have an inherent need to attract residents, to expand the tax base, to attract employers, and to grow, right? That is the ethos of the American city. And one of the paradoxes of growth is that growth creates congestion. Growth creates what people call growing pains of cities, right? And I think within the context of a strategy where, and I should be clear that cities in, say, the 1970s and 1980s did not necessarily see a future other than trying to attract the middle classes back, right? At the height of the sort of the Reagan Revolution and the cutbacks that started with Nixon to federal programs to aid cities, it just didn't seem reasonable to assume that there would be any kind of social democratic approach to reinvesting in cities. That there was a hope for that with the Great Society, and it didn't work out that way. In fact, quite the opposite. And so a lot of cities saw their only option as attempting to attract the middle classes back to cities, first as consumers, right? Things like taxpayer-funded stadiums, and then later as residents themselves. And that was part of Jerry Brown's famous 10K plan for Oakland, where I think he wanted to attract 10,000 residents back to the center of Oakland between 1997 and the mid-2000s. So it was a very conscious policy. But again, once you are attracting higher consuming population back to the center of the city, that higher consuming population in the United States tends to bring cars with it. And if everybody were to bring a car back to the center of the city, then it would be traffic mayhem. And in fact, arguably, you're seeing the results of that in San Francisco with an extra, you know, thick layer of the gig economy of Uber and Lyft, various kind of on-demand delivery services, et cetera, et cetera. So nevertheless, the bicycling becomes a way to kind of navigate this kind of paradoxical situation of needing to grow, but not having anything like the infrastructure that would be adequate to grow without adding tons of cars to an already constrained city. And when faced with that kind of a situation, bicycling starts to look like, as Ed Riskin, who longtime SFMTA head, as he put it, the cheapest investment you can make in, I think what he said was reducing carbon emissions, but also improving quality of life, accommodating growth without adding tons of congestion. So I don't think that this was I also don't think that this was something that was cooked up out of nowhere by people who had a long-term interest in the city growing by any means necessary. I think that bicycle advocates and advocates of growth, particularly of the kind of longer range planning approach like SPUR, kind of met each other, right? And formed quite early, as early as like 2001, I think, very, very strong alliances over the question of smart growth.
Well, let me end by asking you about paths not taken so far anyway, which is you argued that in the past there has been a connection between the left and bicycle advocacy. Yet the kind of advocacy for bicycles that we've seen recently has intersected very too seamlessly with the model of the unequal city, where the cities are for those who are affluent and not for everyone else. How would you like to see, or what would you imagine it would look like if bicycle advocates and the advocacy of bicycles within cities was firmly rooted within a kind of radical critique and a radical politics?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I kind of daydream about a lot of times. But it also, I feel pretty strongly that the bicycle, especially bicycling, kind of as it's currently construed, that the problems go far beyond, right? The issues that I'm raising in the book really go far beyond the what you could do with bicycle policy. I mean, I would love to see a city that had lots of money to invest in high quality public housing, high quality social housing, high quality nonprofit housing, that was not a sort of last resort for people who could not find housing in the private rental market, but that gradually outcompeted the private rental market. It's been really exciting over the past several years to see momentum grow behind the Green New Deal, and especially the thinking about what kinds of cities will need to be built in order to really actually hit carbon emissions targets. And so I think as a first order of business, expanding the affordability of the city, especially for low-income residents, is likely to promote less carbon intensive ways of getting around. I'm not actually necessarily, say, a bicycle purist. I think that the nice thing about bicycles is that they do some of the things that cars do in terms of moving around very flexibly without any of the kind of environmental or without the same kind of environmental and social impacts that and economic impacts on the city. But anything that kind of achieves that, and especially in an equitable way, I think is part of the path forward. But ultimately, it's about the intersection of the kind of built environment that we create, right? The kinds of social infrastructure that we create that expands the role of the public sector or the nonprofit sector in providing the everyday necessities of life. And the reason I think that this is so important is that part of what I think we need to do is move towards a public abundance. And part of that public abundance, I think, would include bicycling for things like quick trips to the store, enjoyable leisure rides, et cetera. And I think there's been some really great research by Daniel Adana Cohen and others about the ways in which the emissions of middle class and wealthy people as consumers get hidden by our focus on reducing their emissions as drivers.
John Stalen, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been really great talking.
John Stalen is the author of Cyclescapes of the Unequal City, Bicycle Infrastructure and Uneven Development. That's published by the University of Minnesota Press at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that book. He is assistant professor in the Department of Geography, Environment, and Sustainability at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.